Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Ariel Aronson, a French to English translator of books, films, TV, and much more. Ariel, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks. It's so nice to be here.
In English. You did a great job. We have talked before when I interviewed Benoit Gallo for his book, The Secret Life of a Cemetery, and he was French, and you did translation like on the spot, which I was very impressed by. And also,
two different skills.
Yeah, I know. And thank God you were there. Now, you describe yourself, so you're a French to English translator.
That's
so
correct.
You never do English to French?
Never.
What? Okay,
no, I
know nothing about the translation business. So there are people who specialize in the one-way flow of the translation.
So typically you translate into your primary language, your dominant language.
And
there are few people, some rare talented individuals who can go both ways. But typically, especially text, like translation, not interpretation, typically you translate into your dominant language.
Now, how did you decide to become a translator? Because I can't believe you as a young person would go, what do you want to do when you grow up? Yes, I want to be a translator.
Yeah,
how did that come about? I mean,
yeah, it's a good question. It's a bit of a sort of esoteric, sort of solitary profession, but so my mother is a librarian, and I've always, she raised all of us to be book lovers, and so I've always had a fascination with books and with literature, and in high school, I don't know, I just developed a passion for languages.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey,
okay.
In suburban New Jersey.
Wow.
Close to Rutgers University, and no one in my family speaks another language, so I was sort of coming from behind. But I don't know. I just thought it was so cool that somebody else could say these words that seemed to mean nothing to it, like the untrained ear, but yet to somebody who spoke that language meant a whole world. And I was just fascinated by it. And so my passion for learning languages was born. I ended up only stopping at two. I sort of wanted to become a polyglot at one point, but realized that learning to fully master just one other language when you start from behind is like a lifelong thing. So I went and I did a semester abroad, like so many other people, in France during my junior year in college. And I was directly enrolled into the university in Tours, France. And so this wasn't like a specific program just for foreign students. I was just like any other French student at the university, which was extremely hard, and my grades definitely reflect that. and they offered, in the course catalog, they offered translation studies. So I decided to just take a class, and it was for them, it was translating, because you're translating into your source language. It was translating into French, which to me was absolutely the hardest thing I'd ever done.
Wow.
But it was just so fascinating. I just loved it. And I thought this is a way to sort of marry my two passions, foreign language and books. So there you have it.
I have to ask you, did you take French in school, like in high school?
Yeah, so I was. I just took French in high school as a second language, just like everyone else.
Yeah, I took. I over the course of junior high to high school, I took 4 years of French, of which I remember nothing. And
I did the same.
And I took 4 years of Spanish, and that was a problem because I took them simultaneously.
Oh wow!
Nah, it's not so good. If you
don't, I did not do that. So you're better than me. Completely tripped up over.
Did you find yourself that you had a facility for language?
I think so. Yeah, I'm not sure why, but it comes easily to me. Or I'm very good at noticing things, and I think whether that be like spelling mistakes. Like I'm a very good editor, so I can notice spelling mistakes on a page, or I can notice when an address is wrong or there's a comma missing. And learning a second language, you know, as a like semi-adult, I think takes a lot of noticing because you have to notice, you know, the grammar differences and the conjugations. And so I think that natural aptitude just made me a little bit more primed to learning a second language, you know, at like 10 or 11 or 12, as opposed to learning it, you know, from birth.
This is really fascinating to me because hearing you talk about it reminds me of when I talk to mathematicians.
I often make that analogy that language can be, I mean, it is inherently very mathematical, but if you think about it as mathematical, it for some people may facilitate the task.
But it's also like there is a facility for it. It's almost like in your DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never, I don't have a, you know, an objective answer to that, but it certainly felt like that for me. Like where others struggled to learn a second language, for me it was, it came easier than some other thing.
I still want to stick with your semester abroad because that's such a thing. It's
a cultural touchstone, yeah.
Had you been to France before? Had you traveled outside the country?
I had saved up all my pennies, and I went on our class trip, junior year of high school, but with, you know, our French class. And that was the first time I'd ever been on a plane, maybe not on a plane, but that was the first time I'd ever traveled abroad, and it was without my, you know, my family. And so that was a learning experience. And then, I guess, 4 years later, I decided to go back.
What an incredible experience. Now, so you find something that you really are passionate about. How do you then move that into a career?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I have to say, I feel like I've just been very lucky. The stars aligned for me. But I want to give, you know, words of encouragement for all of the budding translators out there. For me, my story starts actually in Quebec. So I came back from France. I wanted to become a high school French teacher, but I felt like my French wasn't so solid. So I moved to Quebec because it was, you know, sort of closer to home, but also a French-speaking area so that I could practice my French. And when I was in Quebec, I was working with a man who named Peter McCambridge, who was starting his own literary translation press. And so we became friends sort of outside of anything else, but he was very encouraging of me. He showed me the ropes, how to pitch a translation, how to write a synopsis, how to contact publishers. And so from him, I would say that he's, you know, single-handedly propelled my career into translation. So I've been based in Montreal, Quebec, for the past almost 20 years. And I also have to say that that's fortuitous or another piece of luck, because Quebec and Canada have a lot of programs, government programs, specifically designed, because it's a bilingual country.
Right.
So the programs are specifically designed to fund and encourage, you know, translation and switching between these two languages and having both languages flourish equally at the same time. I mean, that's the goal. I'm in an ecosystem that's very particular.
A lot of people in America, of course, they don't know a lot of things, but they don't realize that to our north is a bilingual country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
legally.
Yeah. Officially. But I have to ask you, is Quebec French the same as French, France, French? And I'll tell you why. I traveled to a lot of Spanish-speaking countries like Mexico and throughout Central America and South America. And that Spanish was very, very different in a number of ways from Castilian Spanish, from the Spanish that is spoken in the Iberian Peninsula. There's a lot of different words that have completely different meanings. Especially slang, there's a different intonation and stuff like that. Is that true for French in Quebec?
Yep, absolutely. The parallel holds 100%. It's in the same way that languages develop, you know, from a mother language and then develop sort of on their own. Quebec has exactly what you were mentioning. It has different intonations. It has different slang. It has different, just as the same as, you know, British English and American English are slightly different.
Really different.
Intelligible.
I had a real problem when I went to Scotland to understand.
And interestingly, I just want to put a little parenthesis. Interestingly, Scottish, so there are Quebec French and Scottish English, or, you know, the English out of Scotland, they don't have parallels per se, but if you translate out of Quebec French and want to retain sort of like that, the layers, the nuances, the cultural, the colonial, I don't know, feel, there are a lot of parallels with Scottish English. So I've read some Scots translations that really nail it, where like American English struggles to nail that feeling out of Quebec.
When you're talking about feeling, I want to get to the root of that. Is that the sort of the cultural backbone of the language, the whole feeling of the language? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, anytime you read, I mean, we all read in different Englishes, right? So anytime you read an English that's out of Scotland, or an English that's out of Britain, or an English that's out of the Caribbean, you know, or out of the Indian subcontinent, you can feel inherently those differences in the language. Like it's sort of this intangible difference.
And it's your responsibility as a translator to maintain that.
Maintain those, yeah.
And try to convey that. It was interesting. I was going to tell you before we went on the air that I first became interested in translation when I think it was, I was 10 or 11 and I read Dante's Inferno.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it was an old translation by Dorothy Sayers for Penguin paperbacks. And, you know, I first read it, and then I realized that when I read about Dante, I realized this was a translation that Dorothy Sayers was translating in poetry, essentially, trying to maintain the poetry. And then, you know, since then, I've read a lot of other translations that have been very different of the same book. And I wanted to ask you, I got to work with you doing vocal translation, auditory translation. How different is the experience doing translating books? And you have done a lot of books. It must be a totally in your mind a totally different experience doing literature versus on the spot translation.
Oh yeah, I don't actually do. There are entire degrees devoted. You mean like interpretation, like simultaneous interpretation?
Well, like you did on the show that we worked with.
Like that happens in the UN, for example. Parliaments. Yeah, that's a completely separate. I mean, it's related, but it's its own degree. You can specialize in simultaneous interpretation. I have colleagues that really work more in that field. I do not have a background in that at all.
But you did it.
I took a lot of notes, and you have to think fast. It's not an area in which I excel. I would never, I would never apply for a job at the UN.
That's an awesome responsibility too. If you're at the UN,
certainly.
Oh my God! But what I'm starting to understand, so there are many different specialties within the field of translation.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And so, do you know from the beginning what your specialty is going to be?
No, when I did I did a 1 year sort of diploma in translation from Concordia University up here in Montreal. And we had to take a range of classes. We had to take legal translation, medical translation.
Oh, wow.
We had to take economic translation.
Wow.
And they all come with their special like lexicons and terminology and, you know, idioms. And some are, you know, better paid than others, and some of them have a different scope of research than others. And then among that, I took literary translation, and that really is that's where I found my home in a creative sense. It's fascinating that, you know, some of my colleagues are and very good friends are also translators, but not literary. They, you know, they tend to be more marketing is also a whole different subset of translation, and that can be crossed over with like localization and transcreation, where you have to like local, you can't translate sort of directly, so you have to localize the product to the target context. But yeah, so everyone has their own specializations, and we all say that we could never do what the other one does.
Slang is going to be difficult to translate.
Yeah, that's a whole different
context. Well, you've translated a lot of both nonfiction and fiction books, so you must have to occasionally come across a French colloquial or slang term. What's your philosophy about translating that?
I do a lot of subtitling, which is great for training the ear to these like colloquial contexts.
Okay.
Right? Because it's all just speech. And that helps me certainly with my like arsenal. My arsenal of language. And I would say that Quebec French has a lot of images, and it has a lot. It's very rich in terms of slang. And sometimes I find that my English, not everyone, but my English can be limited when it comes to finding equivalents.
I'm not joking around, but swearing in any language has got very particular terms and attitudes that they do. Are there things that are not translatable in the that don't translate
So in Quebec, you just find an equivalent that you hope has the same heft.
Okay.
Because in Quebec, a lot of the swears, because of the history behind the country and its roots in Catholicism and everything, a lot of the swears that carry the most weight are related to the church.
Whoa.
And we don't have this in English.
No.
So, sometimes I try to find an equivalent where you would say something, oh, Jesus, or, something that is related to the church. But a lot of our heaviest swearing is not inherently, religious. So that's an entire problem to solve right there.
So do you ever footnote and just put the actual word in there and then footnote it and translate it?
I've not used footnotes in my translations. Okay. I don't love reading footnotes. I know some people do.
Okay.
But no, I don't try to, I don't tend to explain. It's either I leave it in the original sometimes, or I will just translate it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Ariel Aronson, a French to English translator of books, films, TV, and more. What was your first literary translation that was published?
A published translation?
Yeah, yep.
Oh, my very first book was called 21 Days in October. It's a YA novel. I was teaching English in a high school up here at the time, and it was in the curriculum, in the French curriculum. And so the students were reading it for their history class or their French class, I don't remember which. And it's about the October crisis that happened in Quebec and everything that, I don't know, it's a fictionalized account of the October crisis when the Wartime Measures Act was invoked across Quebec to silence some of the what the government deemed terrorists that were rising up against the government in October of 1970 or 71, I can't remember.
Now, you've translated, there's a whole list of books on your website that you've translated, which I didn't have time to read them all, obviously. but you do nonfiction, you've done children's books, and you've done fiction.
Correct.
Honestly, is there one category that you really enjoy translating than the others?
I love translating YA.
Okay, that's not children's books. That's a different thing.
I have done very few YA, I think only two titles, but it's like young adult fiction, young person's fiction, because I feel like it's a really, it's rich in content, but you have to strike the right tone in terms of language and audience. You can't, baby your audience, but it's not also, we're not translating Proust or anything. So I find
La Recherche de Temps Perdu, right?
Yeah.
I can't believe I remembered that from French class.
I have never read Proust.
I've read it in translation, so I have no idea what it, you know, you're always left when you're.
I have not read it in either.
But, you know, somebody always says, well, if you're not reading in French, you're not really getting the full sense of the books. And they say that for everything that's translated. Well, you're not going to really understand what it really is like until you read it in its language. Now, you've.
Well, and that is our struggle as translators.
But you have to do it. I mean, do publishers now come to you to translate their books?
Over the years, I think my first few I spent, you know, pitching to publishers, and then there was a moment in, I want to say, in the early 2010s in Canada, where there just seemed to be a real opening for translation. So publishers were receiving more funding, I believe. I'm not exactly sure, but there just seemed to be a real appetite for translation, and so. Things snowballed, and at that point, I started receiving requests from publishers to do various things, and then that wave has mostly subsided now, and so I'm back to another cycle of pitching and knocking on doors and trying to find publishers for projects.
Now, some of your books, I've got to ask you about two books: "A Boring Wife Settles the Score" and "The Autopsy of a Boring Wife."
Yep, that's a series, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So The Autopsy is book number one, and
when you do,
the other one is book two.
When you go to do a translation, who do you answer to, the author, or do you answer to the editor and the publishing house? Does the author ever check on your translation?
So the author, yeah, that's also an excellent question. Authors are involved to varying degrees.
Do you talk? Do you actually talk, or do you email them or talk with them?
Oh, I always email. So it depends on the translator and the author. Some translator-author combinations work very closely with one another. Maybe they're friends. Maybe the translator just really wants to involve the author. Maybe the author has an excellent grasp of the target language. So it depends. I tend to sort of do my own work, and then at the end, I'll write, you know, either a long Word document or annotate the PDF or write up a long email and then shoot that off to the author. And from that point on, we'll go over some, iron out some sticky bits. But it really depends on your combination of author and translator.
You've also translated nonfiction, some feminist books, it seems. That's excellent. Now, when you're working with that, again, are you working closely with the author to make sure that you get the points across? Because among the books you did, Stolen Motherhood, Screwed, yep. How Women Are yep. Set Up to Fail at Sex, Motherhood, The Mother of All Sexism. These are all sounded really interesting books to me.
Thank you.
It sort of sounded like The Secret Life of a Cemetery was sort of outside the realm in a very different kind of book that you've translated.
Yeah, I loved that project. I would say that nonfiction, and this is my personal experience. I would say that nonfiction in general, I tend to have fewer questions, probably with the exception of the cemetery book, but I tend to have fewer questions because it tends to be written more in like a journalistic style. So it's, the sentences themselves are a little bit more straightforward, and, you know, if I do my research correctly, it tends to, you know, map on pretty easily to English. Whereas literary translation, you know, there's alliteration, there's image, there's poetry, there's, you know, word choice, there's subtext. So it's, there tend to be more questions for authors in literature, in prose.
And children's books must be the easiest because they're simply written. Like you did The Swallow Who Stayed and Butterfly Wings. Those aren't young adult books, are they? They're not.
Those are children's books, yeah.
So that's going to be the most basic books. And the easiest to translate, right?
You know, I would, fun fact, I think the project that I went back and that had the most, you know, iterations or versions of, you know, Word document versions, was a children's book that I did.
Wow.
So it, yeah, the, even if you have, you know, 400 words versus 40,000 words, that doesn't, you know, you have to get each word right. And unless the publisher, if the publisher and the author, also what tends to happen with children's books is that there are, there are illustrations as well. So you have to make sure that the text and the illustrations line up in a way that, these are constraints that you don't have.
Right.
Elsewhere.
We only have minutes left, but I got to ask you. So you've translated a sitcoms and game shows?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Sitcoms sound really hard because you've got to try to maintain the sense of comedy, which is based in another language.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good workout. It's a good brain workout.
So you're doing you're subtitling it, right? You're not doing
correct. Yeah.
You're not doing the voiceovers. Voiceovers.
No. Okay. Although I've also been hired to do, to write the script for the person that would do the voiceover. Right, because there are some steps to doing that. Right, those actors don't just simultaneously translate; they get a script. Yeah,
I'd love to see one of your translated game shows. Like, give me an example. Like, what kind of a game show did you do? Just give me the title.
Like out of Quebec, I don't even remember.
Never mind.
But they're all Quebec shows that nobody in the States would have ever seen.
We're completely out of time, and I still have a ton of questions. My returning guest tonight is Ariel Aronson, a French-to-English translator of books, films, TV, and a lot more. Go to her website. Ariel, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
You'll listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.